Well, go ahead if you would and take your Bibles out and put a finger in Genesis 39 and put another finger in 2 Timothy chapter 2. And I'm going to cheat because I have two Bibles. I want to start out by reading in Genesis 39. Beginning in verse 6, right at the end of verse 6, a very familiar story to us. It says that now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, and it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" As she spoke to Joseph day after day, he did not listen to her, to lie beside her or with her. Now it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. She caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. And you just read this and you got to be thinking, that poor guy, he just doesn't get a break, does he? Joseph started out with such promise, just 17 years old, and his father has set him above his brothers, but the brothers hated him for it, throwing him in a waterless pit and eventually selling their own flesh and blood to a caravan of Ishmaelites. And though he certainly ends up in Egypt as a slave, thereby preserving his life, and not just a slave, but the head of Potiphar's entire household because of his integrity and because of his virtue. In this text that we just read, he ends up having to endure more hardship. This scandalous woman, this adulteress, can't keep her eyes and can't keep her hands off this noble young man, and so we find that he is challenged again. The text tells us here that she grabbed him, and in fleeing away from her, he left the garment in her hand and fled and went outside. That was his response to this. In other words, he didn't sit down and try to teach her about God. That was not the time for evangelism. He didn't try to reason with her. There was no, "Listen, Mrs. Potiphar, before you jump the gun, let me explain. There's going to be consequences if we go through with this." There was none of that. And another thing we don't read that Joseph did is he didn't say no. No, she grabs him, and about the only thing left for him to do is to flee. Joseph knew that sexual temptation is not something that he should stay and battle out. The power of sexual temptation is such that his example teaches us to flee. About 2,000 years later, Paul says in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22, no doubt with this story in his mind, in 2 Timothy 2, beginning in verse 22, "Now flee from youthful lusts and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart." What I want to talk about tonight is I want to talk about that very verse in 2 Timothy 2, verse 22, and use the story of Joseph as sort of a backdrop and some illustrations for us. I want to talk about tonight how to flee youthful lusts. You talk about a subject like that, it's kind of a sticky subject, isn't it? Talking about sex in the church. It's become taboo in the minds of so many, that to even utter the word in a classroom arrangement or especially from the pulpit is met often with disdain. A lot of people don't want their children hearing topics such as this, but I want to say something to all of us, parents especially, but to all of us. Satan is very active in this day and age teaching our children about sex, is he not? Every single day in ways that we cannot even possibly imagine, but in ways that we're certainly aware of. He's doing it in our television shows. He's teaching our children about sex through movies and through radio and through the books that they read, through the internet, through public school, through public immodesty. And if we're going to challenge Satan's evangelism, regarding a topic such as sex or such as lust, we have to deal with it in the church. And we have to deal with it in an honorable way and in a decent way, in a way that God would have us to, that brings glory to Him. But we have to deal with it. The Bible deals with this subject, and so we have to, as God's teachers and preachers as well. So we're going to talk about that tonight, and I hope we can get some participation from you guys. I hope that this is a very practical lesson. Information is always good, but you're going to hear me say this over and over again for as long as I'm here to teach you and to preach to you at this church, that the information does nothing for us unless we can practically apply it to our daily lives. And so I want to talk about three things tonight, and all three things are found in 2 Timothy 2, verse 22. I want to talk about how to flee from euthalus, and then I want to talk about what to flee to, and then as the last part of 2 Timothy 2, 22 tells us, I want to talk about who we need to be fleeing with. There's three things that we need to flee from. And it's not just fleeing with our feet. I want to tell you that this story of Joseph is remarkable, because you can tell in his life that long before this woman grabbed his garment and tried to seduce him, that he had already done some other types of fleeing long before this. Job said in 31 verse 1 of his book, Job 31 verse 1, Job said, "I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin?" What's the first thing we need to flee from? Not our feet, and it's not our mind, but it's what? Right here. We got to flee with our eyes, don't we? And why do you think that's the first thing we need to attack? Any thoughts on that?
We're going to get our eyes off of it.
Right.
Easier, I think it'll be the battle.
Okay. And why is that the case? Is it easier when you're trying to get a weed up to grab the weed by the petals? Where do you want to grab it at? The root, where it comes from, right? And a lot of the problem with this type of sin, with sexual temptation and lust, it doesn't start in the mind. It doesn't even start with the physical action. Long before those two things ever came about, we've had a problem with these two guys right here with our eyes. And that's why Job said what he said. He said, "I have made a covenant with my eyes." Job recognized, I mean, thousands of years ago, that that's where it all begins. Thousands of years later, Jesus reminds us again in Matthew 6 and verse 22, when he says that the eye is the lamp of the body. So then if your eye is clear, the whole body will be full of light. What does that verse mean, that the eye is the lamp of the body? What does that mean? Not everybody at once. If we take in pure things with our eyes, then what is our body going to be? It's going to be pure. If we take in indecent things with our eyes, what is our body going to be? It's going to be indecent. And so the eyes are the lamp of the body. The eyes are where it begins. Long before Jesus condemned the physical act of adultery, what did he say in the Sermon on the Mount to the man who looks upon a woman with lust in his eyes? That he's done what? That he has committed adultery. Okay, so let me ask you this, practically speaking, what are some things that we have to be careful to guard against with our eyes?
When you go, like if you know there's a certain particular place that you know women go to or whatever else, not even about
okay.
men, but like it's a certain place that like you struggle with and you still go there.
Okay. And what are some places where you're sure to find people dressed indecently, or places like the beach, yeah, the pool, bars, which that's pretty self-explanatory. You know, we don't need to be in those. But there are certain places, while we're going to deal with immodest dress, and men especially are going to have this problem with trying to guard the eyes against immodest dress, there's inevitably going to be that problem always, because we find indecency everywhere around us. And so there's going to have to be some bouncing of the eyes that occur there. But before we have to deal with that, we have to make sure we don't put ourselves in situations where what can get out of hand, our eyes, when we're looking at things that we don't need to be looking at. So absolutely, there's places that we don't need to be. What else can we do to guard our eyes?
Movies, television.
Okay.
We
All right? Any of the media, right? Movies, certain movies we don't need to be watching. Of course, even some of the ones that are rated PG and PG-13. I mean, I'll tell you the truth. PG-13 movies today would have been rated R when I was a young man. It is amazing how the Motion Picture Association of America has devolved in their morality. But even some of the PG movies that we watch today, you're going to see things that are going to put images in your mind, and we have to be careful about that. We have to develop a finger trigger on the remote sometimes, don't we, when we're flipping through channels trying to find what to watch. And sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes we have to get rid of cable altogether if this is a problem. Does that sound radical? Stay away from TV and movie and the internet. I mean, of course, I have to be on the internet. Does that sound radical to most of us?
Well, if that's something that you really struggle with, maybe not everyone struggles with it like you do, but if you are
a
person that does, then maybe for
him
it's not so radical.
Okay. How radical do you think something like that would be to Jesus? To actually get rid of our TVs or stop watching TV or movies if it's going to cause us to stumble? Remember when Jesus said in Matthew 5:28 that any man that looks on a woman with lust in his eyes has committed adultery? What did he say after that in verse 29 of Matthew 5? He says, if your right eye makes you stumble, just close them. Right? No. What did he say? Pluck it out. Which is more radical, to get rid of your TV or to pluck out your eyes? Yeah, let's let the TV go first and see if that fixes the problem. And we want that to be the last resort, right, to pluck out the eyes. But see, with Jesus, I mean, Jesus goes ahead and takes it to its ultimate conclusion. If that's not something that you can handle, is protecting your eyes so that you don't open the floodgates for all kinds of indecency to go ahead and pollute your mind, then it would be better to just live the rest of our lives blind than to do what? What does he say at the end of that verse in Matthew 5, verse 29? Than for our whole body to be thrown into hell. So here's a question. We're not talking about, you know, habits. Oh, this might be a good habit to help us to control sexual temptation and lust. This is Jesus saying, if you do not learn to control your eyes, you are going to hell. Whew. That sounds radical. That's the truth, isn't it? And think about it like this, how important this is. If we can control our eyes, then what else have we controlled? We have controlled our mind. And that's where the lust starts. That's where it's starting to be conceived, is within our mind. And then when our mind cannot calculate how to achieve the very things that it lusts after, then physically we may not ever have to flee. So that's where it all begins. Thoughts on that? Very, you know, common concept, but Larry?
I think it's very important. Typically, the differences in men and women and how men are wired and women are wired. And I would see in this passage the greater emphasis given to men. Mm-hmm. It's not that women could not be tempted in that way, but
sure.
I think historically, I think you could fairly well establish that this is a bigger problem for men.
Yeah, I'd agree. And I think that's hard sometimes for you ladies to understand, because you're not men. And we men will tell you sometimes that it gets very, very tough for men. And you still don't understand, because we are all wired differently. And I can tell you that men have a hard time understanding certain things about women too. And all of you men would say amen. But it actually works both ways.
It's beneficial in light of sort of Larry said, and what you just said, with the way men are more stimulated visually perhaps than women are.
Right.
Is to have a good mate who understands that as well. And so if a Victoria's Secret catalog comes in the mail, that it doesn't last.
Yeah.
It doesn't linger. I'm a Sports Illustrated fan. You know, I subscribe to it one time a year. A certain edition comes out, and my wife ensures that if it hits the mailbox, it's somewhere else before I get home. It sort of disappears.
Right, so, right. Absolutely.
It helps having a partner who recognizes that as well and contributes to helping you in that sort of situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to talk about that, and that's the third point we're going to talk about, you know, fleeing with someone is really important, having someone to help hold us accountable for that. But that's an absolutely good point. Walker?
One of the things I appreciate you said earlier about Joseph, the fact that he didn't hang around and say no, he didn't even give the opportunity. He fled. We don't know if he had a temptation there himself. And I appreciate appreciate what was said, because I agree with, you know, if we have a problem with something, we need to not go there. But, you know, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall.
Yeah.
We can have a false sense of being able to overcome something or avoid something and think, well, I can do this because I don't have a problem there. Mm-hmm. But over time, we can desensitize ourselves. And then, you know, that happens probably with the internet a lot. I know it does, with things that, you know, people get caught up in looking at on the internet. They think, oh, this is not going to cause me a problem. But what happens? They get sucked into it and they get taken in that sin.
Yeah.
So we've got to be careful that we don't just say, oh, I can handle this. I can go to the bar with my friends, but I'm not going to drink, or I'm not going to be engaged in this, because over time we allow ourselves, without realizing it, to let our guard down.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think I mentioned this in the last sermon I preached here, that, you know, temptation is easy to talk about, but when it's standing on our doorstep and we're actually experiencing it, it's a whole new ball game. It's just a whole new ball game. And so that's why it's important for us to make up our mind now, you know, certain directions that we're going to decide to do, because it's going to take us by surprise, and that's not the time to make a decision when the emotions are going. So.
Just to add to that, you know, obviously this applies very strongly to young people who haven't experienced things, but... Mm-hmm. Those of us who are older, we've got to recognize that we can fall for that temptation just as easy.
Yeah.
Especially as we grow older and experience things and think, well, okay, I don't have a problem with that. And we can allow ourselves to fall prey to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other thoughts on fleeing with the eyes? Okay, how about fleeing with the mind? Look in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 5. Because ultimately, when we're visually stimulated, that stimulation is going to enter into our mind, and that's where lust begins its conceiving process. But there's a great verse in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5 where Paul talks about taking every thought captive. He says in 2 Corinthians 10, verse 5, we are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And then he says, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. You ever been in that situation where you're trying to live the Christian life, but all of a sudden these thoughts enter your mind and you start having this argument with yourself, like, why am I thinking about it? Why am I thinking about it? La, 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 la. You're trying to get this out of your head. It may not even be a lustful thought. It may be an angry thought. It may be a resentful thought, a thought of malice or something of that nature. But you ever had that go on before? Now you're starting to battle yourself, similar to what Paul talked about in Romans chapter 7. This is what he's saying. He's saying there comes a point when we start getting sinful thoughts in our minds that we have to decide right then and there to use our ability to rationalize and to reason and to take that thought captive to the what? To the obedience of Christ. And one of the things I like about Joseph that he does here, now I made the statement that when she grabbed him, he did nothing but run. He did nothing wrong. There's nothing you could do. I mean, she's getting physical now, and he just runs. But before that, he did reason, did he not? When she first propositioned him, he reasoned with her. And one of the things that he did was he reminded not her so much as he reminded himself. He said, "Listen, your husband has made me master over everything in his house. I'm responsible for this." And in other words, he's saying, I have been blessed by Potiphar, and I'm in this great position because of him. And then not only does he say that about Potiphar, but he says, how could I sin against God? In other words, God who's given me this, God who's ultimately in charge, God who's allowed me to prosper in this house, God who has saved me over and over again, God, etc., etc., etc. For every great quality about God is probably what he was thinking in his mind. And I think what was happening here is Joseph's using the power of rationalization and reasoning in order to curb any kind of thought that could have come about him, any temptation that he could have had to go through with whatever proposition that Potiphar was asking him. And I tell you, there's going to come a time in our lives when lustful thoughts enter our mind that we're going to have to allow our rationalization and reasoning skills to take over our emotion. There's going to be times that we succeed in this, as Joseph did here, and there's going to be times that we fail in this, as David did. And we talked a little bit last night in our lesson how it seemed interesting that Joseph had a lot of successes, David had a lot of failures. Well, we remember where David failed in this instance with Bathsheba. And I've always thought it was interesting what God said to him through Nathan when he was rebuked. He said, I've given you this, I've given you that, I've given you this, and if that had not been enough, I would have given you even more. But here is Joseph saying, Potiphar's gave me this. God's given me that. How could I sin against him? So we see where one man fails in David, we see another man, Joseph, being successful because he's taking captive those emotions and those thoughts that could cause him to lust. And I think during those times, that's when we've got to start reasoning. Now, that's an easier said than done thing, because when lustful thoughts are beginning to get conceived, sometimes we can be overwhelmed by that. But what do we need to be thinking about? We need to be thinking about how much God has blessed us. We need to be thinking about our proper place. We need to think about how if I were to do something like this, this would be like stamping my foot on every single blessing that God has ever given me. And the trust that he's given me to treat this person that I'm lusting after as another child of God rather than just an object for me to lust after. You know, things of that nature. Does that make sense? We need to use our minds to think about the blessings is what we need to do. Any thoughts on that? Does that make sense, Larry?
In our adult class, we talk about some of these things today. And I do think that... thinking through, well, what if I did this, then what? And it's very interesting, again, you know, there's a lot you can think about, and it doesn't necessarily mean you fit every situation, but one of the things that we talk about is how the media pictures this relationship between men and women. And they picture people like dogs, like animals out in the barnyard, and they just go and be together. And the point in reality, you don't want to be around somebody that, I'm speaking from a male-female standpoint, a female who would just be with anybody, go out on a date and just do anything. She doesn't think very much of herself. You know, and you talk about, you know, God's purpose is in that relationship for there to be a commitment, there to be a love. And, you know, like I say, the media pictures it as no consequences. It's just like eating a hamburger. And that's just not reality. It is not reality. And so you end up getting yourself into a relationship with someone who could be a mess. Anyway, there's a lot of possible thoughts as you think through it. And you go, you know, I really want to be with somebody that's trustworthy. Somebody of good character, somebody that can build me up and trust God. It's just like what Joseph wants to Potiphar. And so it's, I mean, anyway, it's just as you really look at reality and not the fantasy world of, you know, that is oftentimes put out there. And you see enough, live long enough in life, you see that.
Yeah.
So I hope that, you know, that's part of the mental process, at least for me, is I think through stuff like that. It's like, wow, I would not want to be with a person like that.
Yeah. I guess a rhetorical question we could ask is if David had the benefit of hindsight, do you think he would have committed adultery with Bathsheba? We'd say no. Well, I don't know. I mean, the passion was pretty strong when he was standing on that rooftop and he's watching Bathsheba. But do you still, even in the midst of that passion, if he could see ahead and know exactly, detail by detail, what was going to happen to him and his family, would he have done that? And we'd still say, no way he would have. Because he was just a shell of the man that he used to be when he died because of the snowball effect of that illicit relationship that he had. And he would have never thought that was the case. But there's something that we need to understand about sin. Is you can be forgiven of sin, but there are consequences that are sure to come. And God has designed every single sin that we could ever imagine to commit to come with some kind of consequence, because it's against his nature and it's against the nature of what he created us to be. And so when we go against that nature, there's problems that are going to come. And so again, these are again just rationalizations that we need to be making in our mind when we're talking about fleeing from lust, youthful lust. Yes, sir.
Well, I appreciate the point you made about the verbalizing, because in either instance, whether it's Job who says, you know, how could I do this? I've made this covenant with lies. Mm-hmm. I think that, whether that's internalizing that and hearing yourself think that or saying it out loud in the instance that mm-hmm. we see with Joseph,
right.
It doesn't just benefit the person that's saying it for themselves. I think she benefited from hearing that. Whether we know that or not, you know, that did put her off for a time. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was important for her to hear how he felt about his position, the respect that he had for his master, the respect that he had for himself, the respect that he had for God.
Yeah.
I think when we say those kinds of things, and I think it benefits us as Christians when we're in circumstances where it's awkward, it's one of those things where, you know, we want to make that stand. I think it's beneficial for us to say why it is that we're refusing to do something, why we're going to go someplace else and not stay there. For our benefit, remind us that we don't need to be there, and for the benefit of the other person that hears it. If nothing else, they understand where we're coming from, and hopefully they're convicted somewhat by that as well. It gives them some pause to go.
Yeah.
Like, hopefully it would have given her pause to think, he is my husband. You know, could I really do this to my husband? Who's he pointed out some really good things that hopefully she would take into consideration as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that point. There is great power in verbalizing what it is that we're thinking. And of course Romans talks about in verse, you know, to chapter 10, you know, if we confess with our mouth that Jesus is Lord, and there's great power in that, and being able to say, you know, not within ourselves, but audibly, you know, I believe that Jesus is the Son of God. And then be able to verbalize, you know, the blessings we had and whatever other reasoning and rationalization we need to get over the temptation that we're experiencing. There's definitely great power in that. That's a good point. Okay, so we're to flee with our eyes, we're to flee with our mind, and then the easy one, which y'all thought we were just going to go to first, is fleeing physically, running away, which is what Joseph did in chapter 39, verse 12. She called him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me," and he left his garment in her hand and fled. That's almost kind of a comical scene when you really think about it. But when you take the comicalness, if that's even a word, out of it, Joseph did exactly what he needed to do. In other words, Joseph didn't think a lot like we do sometimes. Like when we get in those situations, here's what we're thinking. We're thinking, you know, I know this is tough, but I'm strong enough. Kind of like what Walker was just saying. I'm strong enough. I can do this. I can walk on the edge. I can have one foot off the cliff and one on, and I'm going to be okay. You know how many people have fallen who started out saying that? It's been more than who haven't, I can assure you. We get to these situations where we think we can just get right up to the line, and I'm just so strong that there's no way I'm going to fall back. And then that verse that Walker just mentioned, he who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall, is going to come back and bite us in the back every single time. Because when you're in that situation, and God forbid that we would ever find ourselves in a situation as Joseph did in the book of Genesis, but there could be times that come that when we've done everything to protect our eyes and to protect our mind, could be times where something similar like this happens. If it happens to this degree, don't wait, don't teach, don't evangelize, don't reason. You get out of that situation as fast as possible. Respect the power of temptation, of sexual temptation. Respect it and get out of there. And when everything is calmed down, then you can do your teaching and your reasoning and everything else that needs to be required. There's a way out. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13 says that God has provided a way of escape, but we've got to get up and go to that door before it closes. And the time that it's going to close is when we start thinking that we're stronger than what we really are, when we're in the heat of the moment. So we have to. There may be times where we have to flee physically. Any thoughts on that? Yes, ma'am. Right.
Someone else, really. But I think sexual sin is something that you've got to realize, even if you make mistakes, and you can be repentant, you can repent of those and be forgiven, but it doesn't mean it's not going to affect you later on when you tell somebody who you're going to marry that you've done these things or whatever mm-hmm. else. Like you got to think about it's going to hurt that person, maybe not to the degree that it would, you know, back in high school or whatever else, but you've got to remember that the mistakes that you make in this particular area of sin will not only affect you.
Yep. Consequences, right? The way of the transgressor is hard, is what the proverb says. Brad, or whichever one you talks first, go.
I was going to say, that was a good point. As far as 1 Corinthians 10:13, you know, we know that the Lord's never going to put on us more than we can bear. And I always kind of read that verse and thought about whatever temptation I have, there's always going to be at the last second just some way that I can get out of it, and God's going to create this, you know. But really, there was a way of escape for Joseph. And the only way of escape was him just running for his life, pretty much. And that was it. I mean, that was the only option he had at that point. And it wasn't like, you know, this light came in and said, Joseph, this way or something. It was like, he literally had to make up his mind, like, okay, I'm getting out of here. And so, it's easy to rationalize, but sometimes our only way out is just getting out as quickly as we can. The other thing I was going to say, we kind of compared David and Joseph a lot in here. And the interesting thing is, you know, David did give in to his passions and Joseph didn't. And, you know, David was the king and he could get away with pretty much whatever he wanted. And he almost, if you think about it, had the perfect plan to get away with it. It was almost like a TV episode where he had this plan and all these things in the background, like an episode of CSI or something, where he could get away with everything. But we learned in the end that, you know, God knew what he was doing the whole time. And David, in his mind, thought that he was just going to get away with it and no one would ever know about it, but God knew it. God knew.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that's what Joseph knew.
Yeah.
Beforehand is, you know, I could sleep with Potiphar's wife and no one may ever know about it.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, I could do that and get away with it, but God would know.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because when our rationalization begins that says, I'm never going to get caught, remember this, the moment you do it, you're caught. You're caught. Because God sees it exactly as you're doing it. He's saying, caught you, buddy, right as you're doing it. And he's saying, caught you, buddy, it tears him apart. So we're caught when we do it. It's not a matter of whether we will. It's just a matter of, am I going to understand that I'm caught red-handed right now as I'm giving in to this temptation? So, yes, what were you?
Just thinking, Brad makes me think of another thought there. And the case studies between the two, between David and Joseph, giving into that sin, look what else it led to. You know, what was the next step for David? I mean, David started figuring out ways to, how do I cover this up? You know, rather than have that heart that says, I'm remorseful for what I've done, he's doing everything within his power so that he doesn't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, so that it won't become known.
Right.
And I just think that's, you know, here Joseph is taking these evasive maneuvers so that he doesn't have to get in that position where, you know, what's he going to do? But I like what you said, there's emphasis on the verbalizing of it and saying, how could I do this, and reminding and reinforcing who he was and his relationship that he had with God and his relationship that he had physically with Potiphar. But then the act of that fleeing, you know, a lot of people in today, they think it's silly when Christians do some things like, hey, I'm not going to allow this person over to spend the night. You know, this young couple or whatever, they've been dating. And, you know, I've seen it go both ways, right? He's going to sleep on the couch. You know, the roommates are gone, but, you know, we've got an understanding here. I'll be in my room. Mm-hmm. He'll be on the couch. You'll be on the couch. I mean, we sometimes do that sort of thing. And I think we may have the right intent that says, well, we're both committed to being pleasing to God. We're not going to do anything wrong. But how many times has that led to something else?
So, yeah, it's just playing with fire. Yeah.
I really have a great appreciation for people who will go to that length. You know, whether it's they've got a babysitter and the husband doesn't drive the young lady home at the conclusion of the day. The wife takes that young, you know. Just going to those extremes is saying, I'm not even going to put myself in a position. It's not where it's a demonstration of weakness. Rather, it's a demonstration of, let's not create a situation where something might happen. I love the fact that there are Christians who go to that length to say, I'm going to purpose in my mind ahead of time that I'm not even going to put myself in a position where anything like that could happen. Or worse, you know, or likewise, how about people that see a situation and all they see is two people come out of a house and, you know, they put two and two together and say, well, these guys spent the night, or whatever it happens to be. But just going to that length to say, I'm going to be like Joseph and I'm going to flee. I'm going to set up a situation where I don't have to put myself in a situation where I'm going to be tempted.
Yeah. That reminds me of something else. As far as the consequences of this particular sin goes, this isn't a sin that you want to just readily confess, you know, right? I mean, that's just not something you want to really talk about. And that's why we don't talk about it, because sexual sins are very personal and they're very disgusting, you know, as far as looking at them. And we're ashamed of ourselves, but it's hard not to look at someone else who's engaged in something, say, like pornography, you know, and not think, you know, oh, you know, that's nasty or that's terrible and whatnot. So that's a bad thing. And now here's the point I'm making. Because it is like that, the consequences we're going to have to deal with in trying to hide sexual sin is we're going to do other sins to try to cover it up. We're going to, it means we're going to have to lie. We're going to have to deceive somebody who trusts us. And think about people that have, you know, been caught in adultery. I've known of preachers who've been caught in adultery, and they've tried to lie to cover it up because they don't want to have to come forward and say, I just committed adultery with so-and-so, and I just want you guys to forgive me that, because that's a hard thing to have to confess. So now they're going to sin again, and they're going to lie to cover it up. So a sexual sin, no matter which one it is one that's just going to lead to a snowball effect of other sins to try to hide it. And so that's something to think about. You're not just giving in to one sin. You're potentially giving in to a lifestyle of deception that will take years, if it ever could be forgotten, and you could gain your respectability again. So that's how serious these things are. Okay, well, good thoughts. Let's talk about the second thing that 2 Timothy 2:20. I said three things, and y'all thought we had all three of them, and that was like my first point. but that's okay. I mean, we're not going to spend longer than an hour in here, but I do want to talk about the second thing that 2 Timothy 2:22 talks about, because we talk about fleeing from youthful lust, and we know that, but we need to know the rest of this verse too, because there's other things that it talks about fleeing in regards to. And the second thing that verse tells us is to pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace. So flee youthful lust, flee from this, but flee to these things: righteousness, faith, love, and peace. Now, let me ask this. When Joseph fled, where did he go? Text tells us he went outside, right? I'd suggest to you that long before he went outside, he fled to these four things: to righteousness, faith, love, and peace. In order to conquer a sin like sexual temptation, it's not just a matter of fleeing from something. We have to flee to something as well. I always think about that passage in Matthew 12, about the Matthew 12, verse 43, where it talks about the unclean spirit that leaves the man, and he goes to waterless places, and then he doesn't like it there, so he comes back to the man, and he finds his place unoccupied, swept, and put in order, and so he takes seven more unclean spirits with him. And the point I want to make with that is our lives and our minds are not likely to be a total vacuum. It's not going to be suddenly that we empty our minds of temptation and sexual vices and then just leave our minds empty. That's not going to happen. We need to, at the same time that we're leaving these things out of our mind, we need to be filling our minds back up with good things, with virtuous things, righteousness, faith, love, and peace. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, Romans 12 verse 2, Paul talks about that when he says, "And do not be conformed to this world." He says, "But be transformed by the renewing of your mind." Renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. So then with the renewing of the mind, what we're talking about here is a transformation of our person. That's talking about getting the lust and the sexual temptation out of our mind and filling up our minds, where we got that out, with good things that we can focus on, things that are good and pure and wholesome. And I bring that up because I think that's what Joseph had in his mind. And if you read between the lines of the things that he said when he was trying to reason with Potiphar's wife the first time, you see some glimpses of that righteousness and that faith and that love and peace in Joseph's rationale. For instance, righteousness. I believe that Joseph fled to righteousness when he was reasoning with Potiphar's wife. What is righteousness? It's just being right. It's doing what is right, not what's convenient and not what feels good. And you know, Joseph wasn't a stupid man. He knew how much pull Potiphar's wife had in that house, that she could go and tell those servants supposedly what he had done and cause that snowball effect in his life. He knew that she had some pull. Joseph had to have known that if he was to reject her, that there was going to be some temporal consequences that followed him if he did that. And I say that to say that that's going to be the case with a lot of us as well when we find ourselves in situations where we're going to have to decide if we're going to do what's right or what's convenient. And we're thinking about doing what's right. What's going to come in our mind is, if I do what's right, she may break up with me, or he may break up with me, or if I do what is right, this is going to cause me some kind of inconvenience at my workplace or this other function. If I do what is right, it's going to cost me some amount of suffering, but if I do what is convenient, I won't have to endure all that. And so that's what Joseph did. He knew that. He knew there was going to be consequences. I firmly believe that. But the thing about lust and sexual temptation and making sure we don't put ourselves in situations it's going to be crazy to get out of, and I've heard good parents tell their children this: you've got to make up your mind before this ever happens what you're going to do if this happens. That is something that every child needs to do, especially you guys in college. You may not be in this situation where you're going to have to flee or you're going to have to do something drastic like Joseph did, but you need to be thinking about already what you will do if that situation does happen. And you need to make up your mind right now it's going to happen, because you know that if you do that, that means there could be temporal consequences for you. But you need to decide now so that you're ready for it. And so when the temptation happens, you're not going to be caught by surprise by the power of that temptation, so that you give into it, because you just made up your mind months ago, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it just because it's right. It's the right thing to do, and I'm going to sleep good tonight, so I'm going to do this. So you got to flee to righteousness, and I think Joseph did that. You have to flee to faith, he says, righteousness and faith. Well, what kind of faith? Well, again, Joseph wasn't a stupid man. He probably knew what this was going to lead to. And Larry and I were talking earlier today, it's amazing he didn't get the death penalty. And that makes us wonder sometimes if Potiphar didn't know what kind of reputation his wife may have had, because any man in normal circumstances in that society who was caught doing something like that with the captain of the bodyguard's wife, he would have been dead. A Hebrew slave. I mean, think about the racial overtones in this passage when she's talking about it. This Hebrew slave that came in to make sport of us. He would have been dead. The fact that he wasn't dead tells us that maybe he was a little bit onto it, but he probably had to do something, or maybe he would have been the laughingstock of the bodyguard if he didn't do something, you know. But we don't know all these things. But think about Joseph. He had no benefit of hindsight. He had no idea what was going to be the consequence to his action. We have the benefit of hindsight, so when we read this, when she grabs his garment, we think, oh, it's going to be okay. He had no idea whether it was going to be okay. The only thing he had to stand with and to stand by was his faith in God. That God had got him this far. This is a hairy predicament I'm in, but he's done it before. He's going to get me out of another jam, and that's where faith is going to come in. And it may be when we get in a really tight bond that our faith is the only thing that we have to hang on. But the wonderful thing about faith is it's proved itself time and time again that it's of substance and of things hoped for. So, any thoughts on that? Fleeing to righteousness, fleeing to faith. We're not talking about fleeing physically to something, but again, and mentally and spiritually. What about love? Do you think Joseph showed any kind of love for Potiphar or for God and what he said to Potiphar's wife? Why do you suppose he loved them? What did he say? What did he say that would indicate that?
He was thankful for all that they had done for him.
Okay. He was thankful for everything they had done for him.
How could I do this to them?
I mean, not just to anybody, but to them. These two individuals specifically. How could I do this to him? There was a great amount of love that he had for them. Let me tell you what love is not. Love is not, if you love me, you'll do this. That's not love. That's lust. And it's manipulation is what it is. But love is being able to look at the blessings that God has given us and say, you know, It would be the worst possible sin that I could ever do this to one of God's creatures and to myself after everything God has blessed me with. I love him too much to do this. Love is taking out a young girl or boy and caring enough about the fact that the parents have sweated blood in nights of in a prayer for their child to try to keep them pure, and they're placing that child in the care of your hands as you take them out on a date, and you're going to respect the fact that they've worked hard to raise their child to be everything that they can be. That's love. And love is respecting another one of God's creatures to know that God wants that creature to be saved and not to be an object of our lustful affections. That's love. And love is very different than lust. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, when it goes back to even imagining being with a person like this. You know, the world's view of the sexual relationship is the dog-eat-dog world. The world, what I call a throwaway people. You use them and they're like a wrapper and you throw them away. Mm-hmm. See, God's view is where we're trying to understand one another and build one another up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, even one may have a desire, I need to realize, like it's already been stated, that has consequences on the conscience, has consequences in other areas. And if I really love this person, then there's a process God has given that is honorable,
mm-hmm.
that will build up. I can take this path and I can tear down and have consequences I never anticipated.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, God hadn't left us hanging out to dry with this temptation. He's provided an avenue in marriage. And Paul even suggests in 1 Corinthians 7, say, hey, if this gets that bad, go ahead and get married, you know, and that's the avenue God's given for sexual relationship that makes it wholesome and pure and undefiled. So, absolutely. Yes, sir.
I was thinking, you know, we hear John 3:16 all the time, you know, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. That he demonstrated his love. Not the love the world talks about where it's this sort of fluffy, you know, whatever. But love is about sacrifice. Mm-hmm. You know, from the very beginning, God has made that clear when he demonstrated his great love for us. And it was by giving up his son, mm-hmm. offering his son. And when we read about love, it suffers long. Love, all these things are about, the true love that we're talking about is giving, it's enduring, it's suffering. And I think that's sort of what we see here, is we see Joseph having this great love for his God and love for his master, and willing to say, you know what, I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen, but I'm going to suffer whatever I have to suffer. It makes me think Walker's been leading us in a study of Daniel, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are confronted with a very similar set of circumstances where, you know, these men don't really like them very much. They get the ear of the king, and they say, hey, you need to make a decree. And then they know immediately what they're going to do with that. And they're going to use that against them and accuse them of not bowing down to them. And the way that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you know, when they're talking to King Nebuchadnezzar is, you know, you can throw us into this furnace, you know, and who knows? We know our God's capable of delivering us, but he may mm-hmm. not.
Yeah.
And I just love the faith that's demonstrated there and demonstrated by Joseph that says, you know what? She's got my cloak. Yeah, this is probably not going to be a good situation for me, but does that stop you from, you know, we don't see him go back in to get his cloak to say, hey, I need to sort of get that because this could be a problem. He doesn't worry about that. He just leaves and yeah. says, hey, you know, what's going to happen is going to happen, but I know I've gotten myself out of the situation and I'll trust God. And if his will is for me not to survive this situation, so be it, but at least I've been faithful to him and I've demonstrated my love for him in making the sacrifice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, righteousness, faith, love, and then peace. He says peace, and you don't really see peace in what Joseph says as much as it is probably implied. I think about Joseph sitting in those chains in the dungeon. He could have been in chains in the dungeon anyway if he had done what he had done, if he had really done what he had done. What's the difference between him sitting in the dungeon having actually done it and him sitting in the dungeon having not done it? He knows he didn't do it. Peace of mind, a clean conscience. And boy, we can never underestimate the value of having a clear conscience. That is a wonderful thing that God has given us, the conscience. It is that thing that commends us when we do what is right, as Paul said, or it is that thing that keeps us up all night saying, you know you shouldn't have done it, and I'm going to keep you up all night to remind you that you shouldn't have done this. And that's a wonderful thing. We hate it. But he's given it to us as a tool to help to guide us to, in doing what is right. I mean, that is something that I believe is implied, at least, even though it's not explicitly stated or implicitly implied by what he says. It's something that certainly he would have experienced. He would experience a lot of peace knowing that what he had done was right. And I'll trade 2 years in a dungeon or more. It was probably more since we don't really know exactly how long, I don't think. But I trade that amount of time in a dungeon with peace of mind than I will a lot longer than that with a guilty conscience. We all know what a guilty conscience feels like, and it is not a pleasant experience. So that's another thing to think about fleeing to when we're thinking about getting all of these temptations and lustful thoughts out of us is fill it back up with righteousness, with faith, with love, and peace. And we've got all those things filled in us, and then we've gone very far. So, Yvette?
You might be about to make this point, but there's a lot of different kinds of peace. Inner peace is what
yeah.
you described. Right.
You
have that, and peace with God,
yep.
having done what was right. But also, adultery does not bring peace.
Yeah.
It brings turmoil.
Yeah.
And God has rules for our good, and when we abandon His rules, we abandon peace.
Yeah, you want the captain of the bodyguard chasing after you? I don't. so that's a great point. I was only going to deal with that one aspect of peace, but you don't want Potiphar coming after you, and you certainly don't want God coming after you. God, who held Jacob's or Joseph's destiny by a string, it seems, in some situations, and managed to pull him back up to exalt him. You don't want to break that string. Absolutely good point. Well, let's look at the third and the last one. So he says in 2 Timothy 2:22 to flee from youthful lusts, and then to flee to righteousness, faith, love, and peace. But then he says to flee with. He says with those who also call on the name of the Lord with a purity of heart. Who's he talking about here, fleeing with? Just some old Joe we meet on the street. There you go. Other people that are like-minded in faith. And here's something where we can't really talk about Joseph with, because who did Joseph have in the book of Genesis to flee with, to turn to call, to email, to text? You know, who did he have to communicate with to help him, to stand by him, to pray for him? Zip. He had nobody, not in that idolatrous nation. There was nobody in Egypt that he could flee with that could help him. And that tells us, as we talked a little bit about this last night, what an advantage we have even over someone like Joseph, that we have a church family, that we have friends who are trying to conquer the same battles that we're trying to conquer, who are running the race along with us, who, though we don't talk about it with one another as much as we probably should, know what we're experiencing when it comes to lust and sexual temptation. So he says here, find people who are of like-minded faith, who are pure of heart, those who call on the name of the Lord, and flee with them. These pure of heart, these are not sinless saints. I always like the Beatitude, blessed are those who are pure of heart, for they shall see God. That's not people that are perfect. The woman that washed Jesus' feet with her tears, if the rumor is correct, was far from a pure woman. But she was pure of heart because she sure desired to do what was right and to be everything she could be. And that's the kind of people that we need to put in our lives. And we put people like that in our lives that can encourage us and strengthen us, can help even hold us accountable in situations that we find ourselves in. We're going to be so much better off. What happened to Amnon in 2 Samuel when he hung out with his friend Jonadab? You know, Amnon had that big crush on Tamar. And he had a buddy named Jonadab who gave him some very bad advice. Said, just go lie on the bed and pretend like you're sick and go tell your dad that, bring Tamar in here to give me some food. It's terrible advice. And there's people like that. There's people, if we bring our temptations to similar to what Amnon had, who will give us some very bad advice. I'll tell you how you can score. They'll tell you that. And there's going to be other people who say, I want to help you, brother, to be everything that you can be. I wonder how that story would have played out with Amnon if he had had a good friend to give him some actually good advice. Well, Amnon wouldn't have been dead, number one, because Absalom killed him for doing that to his sister. But then Tamar could have lived a normal life, and he practically ruined her life with what he did to her, with raping her. He ruined her life. The strained relationship between Absalom and David might not have ever existed, and therefore Absalom wouldn't have sat at the gates and eventually took his kingdom and then ended up hanging by, in a tree by his own hair and losing his own life. I mean, we don't think about the power of influence until we can look at it in hindsight. What one bad relationship can do to our lives is incredible when we see it from hindsight. And that should tell us all the more how important it is to make sure we surround ourselves with people that are, we say, help us get to heaven. People who will help us get to heaven. So this doesn't just tell us that we need to marry someone who's going to help us get to heaven. What does it tell us about the people we should be dating? Probably they should be of like-minded faith as well, wouldn't you say? I mean, wouldn't that be the wise thing? Look, I won't go so far as to say it's a sin to date someone that's a non-Christian, but do you think it's wise? Especially young ladies, when you're going to have to look to a man as the head of your family, who you're going to look to for spiritual leadership as well, for him not to be a Christian and to be able to guide you in moral principles. Is it wise to put yourself in that position? And I'd say the same thing with men as well. You want a mother to raise your children, to love the Lord. Is it wise to risk marrying someone who might not do that? And I'm not saying that it's guaranteed if you marry a Christian that that's ever going to happen, but it sure is wiser to do so. You agree or disagree?
Well, I think what happens is whenever that choice is made, it's in that moment. It's those two people, and there's always the thought that you're going to be able to have the influence over another person that you would hope that you would be able to have. But unfortunately, you're lacking that hindsight to say, okay, well, what if that doesn't work out? What if you do get married, and then when you have kids, and then that person, whether it's he or she, elects not to be faithful to God, they're always going to have that influence on the children, and it'll always be a struggle. And for those of us who have lived any amount of time and have seen normally how that plays out, to me, it's a rare instance where there's success in that. I'm always thankful to God when there is. Yeah. But there's been so many instances where there hasn't, and it's a struggle. It's a lifelong struggle with a mate that's trying to be faithful to God, but their partner doesn't share that same desire.
Yeah.
So there's always going to be, you know, that even a person that's good, you know, if he or she doesn't have that desire to serve God, there'll always be that pull away from things that are right and things that are godly.
All right, so
for him and for the children.
Yeah, so let me go ahead and solicit the help from my married friends here. When you get married, do you change your spouse? No. All right, so all you guys dating who say, oh, it'll be okay because I'll just be able to change them, get that out of your mind. You're not going to change them. Now, through your example, God can change them, But you can't change them. The will is too strong for someone like you and I to just completely turn that around. It just doesn't happen. And I think that's important to understand. And we're giggling a little bit about it because it's kind of funny, but it's serious too. It's just not going to happen. God's got to change them. And God can change them. And we've known of marriages, Christian marriage, a non-Christian. Eventually the non-Christian becomes a Christian, and it's a happily ever after sort of situation. But I'll tell you, the blood, sweat, and tears that is involved in getting them to that point sometimes can be excruciating. Allison? Sure. Absolutely.
You can marry a Christian. That doesn't mean their heart is pure.
Absolutely.
On the right path. Mm-hmm. So it's not just we kind of have like a checklist of, you know, what we kind of want in a mate.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just check off, okay, I have a Christian. Because people can claim a Christian and not be.
Right,
so
right.
It's important to focus on the heart of the person that you're dating rather than what they are.
Yeah. No, it absolutely does, because I think that's what the verse says. He didn't just say disciples or Christians. He says those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. I mean, it sounds like the real deal is what he's talking about. And of course, a Christian's a Christian, you know, but not everybody that's in the church is the Christian that they need to be. And that's something to think about as well. But again, you know, and we can talk about marriage. It's important to, you know, marry somebody who's going to help you get to heaven. But I'm telling you, we got to start earlier than that. We have to start with that when we're dating and when we're looking for a potential mate. We have to be looking for qualities of someone that's going to help me in my pursuit of righteousness and who's not going to hinder me. And that's just so important. More important than the than the butterflies that you feel when you're around them. I guarantee. Yes, sir.
Thinking about responsibility, you know, sometimes we're looking at our children, especially as they get older, and we're looking for someone. And of course, we can't arrange marriages, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, right?
But I think sometimes parents get to the point where they're like, why aren't there any eligible this or that? And we got nobody to blame but ourselves. I mean, if we're, as parents, doing the right job with our children and raising them to be the kind of people they need to be, they will be the right kind of husbands. They will be the right kind of wives.
Right.
I mean, so we're all responsible for that. And the other thing I was going to say, you talked about Joseph having to stand on his own. And what's always impressed me about that is there are times when we have to do it on our own. We're in a situation, whether it's a business situation or a situation where we find ourselves alone with some other person and there is nobody else to call on at that time. And I love the fact that we have a man like Joseph who was successful in that. You know, he didn't go, well, I don't have anybody else around. Just like in the story of Daniel, those young men, they didn't have a lot to lean on. It sounds like a lot of other people just went along with the decree. Well, I don't want to get in trouble here, so I'm just going to bow down. Standing out in a crowd like that and not having a whole lot of people, it's interesting that God is very clear that he demonstrates that it can be done. But you said it. You alluded to the notion. I think one of the reasons we don't take advantage of each other is we're too proud. You know, we don't want to go to somebody else and say, I'm struggling with this. And it's the pride that prevents us from doing that. Mm-hmm. And I think we do each other a disservice because in instances when someone does come to us and confide in us, we can't keep our mouth shut about it. And we will share that fact with somebody else, which immediately makes that person regret they ever shared that with us.
Yeah.
It puts them in a very tough situation. I can remember a brother in a study we were having. And we talked about a very sensitive subject that no one would want to be, you know, associated with. And the brother he brought it out and said, I've been guilty of this. Mm-hmm. You know, and I see two reactions to that. One with me was just overwhelmed with this humility to be able to say that he had that situation. He had battled that. But he was doing it because I think it helped him, and he knew it would help others. And there's a lot of sacrifice involved in putting yourself out like that.
Yeah.
And so you can be humble by that, or you can be the other side that says, oh, I can't wait to go tell so-and-so that wasn't here, you know, what he said he's been involved in. We do that to each other when this is such a struggle to be faithful in this world. God clearly tells us it's going to be a struggle, that you're going to have to take up your cross daily. All the language indicates it's not something that's easy. And yet, we cut each other's legs out from under us when we should be covering each other's backs and being there for each other. We should be a lot more open with each other with what our struggles are. Because, you know, I've learned in my short time on earth that there are other people that have the struggles that I have. And you know what? There's some benefit in having those conversations and learning how they've been able to overcome it and what's helped them. Those are all good things for us to take advantage of. But I think our pride prevents us from doing that. And then the way we handle the situation hurts that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the other aspect of this. It's not just about being careful who we date and careful who we marry, but it's about running with people that can help us when we do feel like I've done everything I can to hinder this from getting in me, but I'm caught and I don't know what else to do. Find somebody that you trust, another brother and sister Christ, and talk with them, pray with them, and let them hold you accountable. We don't like that idea of accountability towards one another. I tell you, that's what a local church is really about. It's about accountability to one another, helping each other get to heaven. Hebrews 3, verse 12, beware lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief that falls away from the living God, and encourage one another daily. That's the idea of keeping watch over one another to make sure there's nothing going on that could hinder our salvation. And we have to learn to use each other. I know there's some people you don't want to talk to. You don't have as much confidence in some people as others. There's somebody that you trust. And you may find if you confess something to them and talk to them, you may find out that they struggle with the exact same thing that you do. But don't be afraid to use one another in your travels through this life. You're going to need help from time to time. So that's part of what this verse is talking about. It's not just fleeing from. Watch the eyes, watch the mind, use the feet if you have to. And it's not also about fleeing to righteousness, faith, love, and peace. It's about fleeing with. We're going on this together. We're battling these sins together and these temptations together. Let's use one another in order to conquer these things. So, That's all I had. Are there any concluding thoughts? Anything we didn't talk about? Anything you want to? Yes, sir.
Two are united in marriage, they have no right to be with each other in an intimate way. And when you're talking about being with somebody and having somebody help you, if you're alone with that person, if it's a person of someone you trust, someone you're close to, possibly a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and you're sharing thoughts in that way, those types of conversations can very easily lead to temptation. And I think of the perspective being that two married people, we've talked about putting up hedges around ourselves so that we don't enter into a relationship with someone else that we don't belong to, don't have a right to be with. But also, as an unmarried person, we don't have a right to anybody. And I think of, I didn't have that perspective when I was in high school or college, and I was thinking, how would I feel if my dad went over to some lady's house by himself and spent, the evening on into 11 o'clock, 11:30, and then he came home to us at home? That would feel strange, wouldn't it? That would feel wrong. But yet, boyfriends and girlfriends have no problem doing that. And they think, and I thought, it's just what the dating relationship is. We spend time with each other and we spend private time with each other. But think about it, if it was me spending that time with a single young lady at that time, that's not right. And nor is it correct for two young individuals to spend that time with each other because they don't belong to each other. And I think of, how important is it to preach the truth on this? And I think of John the Baptist, because it cost him his life to tell the truth that you don't belong to that person. And he felt it very important to explain that and to teach the truth on this very topic.
Yeah, very good. Absolutely. Any other thoughts? Well, I appreciate y'all being here for a very important topic, and I hope you got something out of it. And let's take this stuff with us and be thinking about it some more. I guess we'll have a word of closing prayer. Drew, you want to lead us in that?
Sure.
Okay.
Our Father in heaven, we are thankful for the time that we have had tonight to come together and open your word, study it and apply it to our lives so that we may become better servants of yours. I pray that all we have done here tonight, the discussions, the thoughts, have all been pleasing to you and acceptable in your sight. Father, we pray that you would be with us all as we leave here tonight, bring us all back tomorrow night at the appointed time. Lord, so we pray.